Welcome, everyone, joining us here tonight on the Kings County Radio Club's Technical Question and Answer Net. My name is Roy. My call sign is AC2GS, and I will be your net control operator for this informal net. I will be your host, and Bob, KD2NVB, will be my co-host on this exploration into amateur radio technology. The purpose of this net is to provide a platform for discussion and to offer our answers, as well as promote a conversation among all participants of this net. The club maintains an archive of these technical nets on its web pages, and we offer original articles and reviews on many topics covered during these technical nets. We also publish technical puzzles for our participants to ponder and as a starting off point to discuss important concepts. Tonight's TechNet puzzle is posted on our club's website. The link can be found on the front page of our website in orange colored type, but if you would like a simple URL to find it, just type into your browser puzzle.kc2rc.com. Also, we will be offering a streaming service for those who cannot receive our repeater signal. Just point your browser to stream.kc2rc.com, and we also have an Echo Link node available for use. Just point your Echo Link application to the node KC2RC-R. This net is scheduled for the second and fourth Wednesday of each and every month. All of this information can also be found on our club website, which is www.kc2rc.com. Members as well as non-members are welcome to participate, although we do appreciate it when our fellow hams join our club. And as always, an application is readily available on our club's website. No question is too simple. No question is dumb. All wisdom begins with the asking of questions. If you have a question, it deserves to be answered. Our format tonight will be to ask for participants to check in only if they have questions or comments for this net. Please give us your first name, your call sign, whether you have a question or a comment. The net will then address each question in order. I will try to provide a cogent answer, and Bob KD2NVB will join in as well. If any other listener has any further facts or opinions, they will be free to break in with the word comment and, when recognized, offer their knowledge or experiences to us all. If anyone has any suggestions for future topics of interest, please let us know either here or use our email address, which is tech@kc2rc.com. So here we are. Let me welcome Bob, KD2NVB. How you doing, Bob?
Roy, I'm doing fine. Good to be here. Look forward to a good net. Some people are out there. So back to you, Roy.
Okay, very good. If there's anyone out there with any questions or comments for tonight's TechNet, please. Also want to point out the TechNet puzzle has an illustration, so you really have to look at the picture in order to answer the question. So keep that in mind. So when you get a chance, look it up on your web browser and take a look at the image. It's a relatively simple question with a relatively simple answer, but if you can't see the illustration, it makes it incredibly difficult, if not impossible. Anyway, with that in mind, I will open the net for any questions tonight. If anyone has any, please hit that push to talk and give us your information.
Alpha Delta 2 Delta Uniform.
Yes, how are you tonight? What can I do you for?
So I finally got permission to go up on the roof of the tall building I work in. And there, I can put up a wire antenna. I tried it out. It works well. I did an NFED once and an NFED random wire once. Let me let it drop. There's a big steel catwalk. How do I do a counterpoise with an NFED half-wave? Like, do you somehow attach it to the, like, alligator clip it to the steel catwalk? ADTDU.
It sort of depends on the question at hand. The way you started it was, how do you connect the counterpoise? Hopefully you're connecting the counterpoise at the other portion of the ballon. You have either a 9-to-1 for a non-resonant random NFED, or a 49-to-1 or 64-to-1, and they usually have two connections. So you would connect it to the other input of that ballon. Can you connect it to a large conducting item? You can try. You can see how it works out. They might have lightning proofed it and grounded in some way, in which it's not going to be quite as useful, but you can give it a try.
If I use an antenna analyzer and try different counterpoise, what am I looking for? Just SWR, or is it lightning grounded? Will SWR show zero and it just be it's just going in the ground? Over.
Well, if you're going to use a VNA, you're going to try and find valleys. What you'll probably see in the sweep is high levels of mismatch, where it is as far away from 50 ohms of impedance as you can imagine, and that it will approach 50 ohms or 1-to-1, and it might not reach it. So you might have either a resonance or a pseudo resonance that's at a higher SWR, and you might have more than one resonance with different impedance values for the different drops. So you're looking theoretically for a drop along the sweep that it comes as close to a 1-to-1 SWR or a absolute 50 ohm impedance as you can find.
You're 60 stories up. Does it make sense to do horizontal, or do you somehow try to elevate the middle anyway and like zip tie a painter's pole with a catwalk and elevate it like 10 feet and do an inverted V? Or it should, like, is there like theoretically a bad shape?
Well, I mean, congratulations at that distance, elevation. You don't have to really worry about bringing something a little bit higher up because, going from, 60 feet to 70 feet, not that much of a difference. The ground is considered earth ground, not the surface of the roof of any kind of elevated structure. So probably your main assessment's going to be made mechanically. What's the most easy and or mechanically stable and secure placement for the wires? You don't have to worry about raising the elevation much because you're starting off at the top of a hill or a mountain. So don't fret too much about putting one end of the end fed a little bit higher than the rest. They're all 60 feet elevation as far as physics is concerned.
Okay, that makes sense. And it makes it a little easier to set up if I could just do it horizontal and try to keep it away from the large metal.
Yeah, I mean, sometimes it benefits you to try and finesse things, and sometimes it's diminishing returns. In this case, it's very much diminishing returns.
I'll let you know how it goes. This is going to be a lot of fun.
Yeah, I hope that you do. I hope you come back and we can talk about it. And also, I look forward to seeing pictures on the Discord. I've been following the Discord server.
Just put a video up of what the catwalk looks like.
Oh, okay, very good. I hope we get a lot of use out of the Discord server. I put a couple of bets out of what's going to become of it. I think it's going to be a kind of a generational divide. I think that a majority of people consistently interacting with it will be under 40, and we'll be lucky to have a few people over 70 who have anything to do with it. But we'll see. I might be completely wrong on this.
I mean, it's just a super stable, like, easy-to-use chat platform, and it allows you to have a continuous conversation where you'd otherwise talk once a week and have media threaded in.
Yeah, I know. I use Discord for other things. I'm well aware of its existence. It's just that you haven't had the joy and privilege of 10 years ago. I joined this hobby at 2011. At that point, there were more than enough older hams who were really despised computers. It was sort of amazing. You would bring the subject up to them, and you would see their face change, and they'd have to either explain that they would never let a computer into their shack, or they would kind of dismiss the whole technology as it's the toy that they use to send messages to their grandchildren. So thankfully, over the last 10, 12 years, things have changed, probably because those people have shuffled off this mortal coil, and there's less of them. There was a weird, one of the fascinating things, I was incorrectly assessing this hobby as full of people who love all kinds of gadgets and technology. It's not. It's primarily people who like radios. But, you know, some of us like other things as well.
I'm astounded at the amount of high technology that I see old guys in radio conquering. It's guys that are, like, you know, deep into computers. And one guy built his own steam engine to boat. That was the best rich guy out there, so...
Well, you know, steam engines is another thing. Mechanical things, again, is not everyone in ham radio. I have found for the most part, the guys up there in years who are tinkering with computers now, if you ask them, they spent a significant portion of their unretired years as a member of an IT department. So that's kind of their into computers. I'm trying to think of guys who are very, very nimble with computers in their 70s. And that seems to be pretty much most, if not all of them. I mean, one of my great friends who became a Silent Key, Dick K2RIW, who used to be the host of the Limark Technical Net, was a brilliant electrical engineer. He was a particular expertise in antenna design, and he was so dismissive of computers that he had his son, who also was an electrical engineer student at the time, his son was in charge of the computers. He would have nothing to do with them. So, you know, it's a shame, but you know, the IT guys, yeah, there's a couple of IT guys in their 70s who are sharp as a tack when it comes to computers. But guys who weren't kind of playing around with computers in the 80s and the 90s, when they get up into their 70s, it's kind of like the VCR with a flashing 12 on the clock, because they don't want to be bothered with reading the instructions of how to set the timer.
It's weird to me the youngest generation seems to not be using computers. They just look at a phone.
Well, I think it kind of some of them do. Again, it's an interesting phenomenon. There seems to be an innate lack of curiosity lately, which I find very depressing. I'm curious about all kinds of things. There are some young people out there. If you ask them how a TV set works, they would tell you, you plug it in, you turn it on. That's how a TV works to them. You ask them, well, but what about the physics? I mean, how does the image get on the screen? They just kind of shrug and change the subject.
QZV.
I don't know that I could 100% accurately describe how a television works. Maybe LEDs make it easier. AD2DU.
Okay. I mean, I don't expect almost anyone to know exactly how to build a television from scratch. Just vague details. It's just that the bravura that some people have that, you know, TVs work by plugging it in and turning it on kind of shows a limited curiosity of things. And by the way, I just want to say hello to William. I see you on the Echo Link. You are recognized. We'll talk to you in a second, William. Anyway, don't want to sound like a cranky old guy. I thank you, Alex, as always, for your question and your participation. Hopefully you'll have some other questions as the night progresses. Let's turn our microphone towards William. How are you doing, William?
D2CV. Yeah, I was listening to you guys talking about all these old guys.
I'm curious how you find it. I find that... Like I said, when I joined this hobby about 13 years ago, I was kind of disappointed. I thought everyone was sort of going to be like me. We're curious about all kinds of technology. But I'm telling you, I got a lot of pushback at the beginning from guys, you know, when I mentioned that I had a software-defined radio. It was like waving a red flag at a bull or something. There were more than a few guys who were antagonistic towards computers. Are you there, William?
D2ZV, didn't you get my transmission?
I got your original transmission, but I didn't get a reply to my response.
Oh, okay, so that's fine. I don't know how much you guys have covered today, but certainly we saw the solar eclipse on Monday.
No, actually, I didn't. It was just going to be a partial eclipse in Brooklyn and Queens, and I know other people who kind of, they didn't get glasses, and I didn't get glasses, and so they kind of faked it by just looking at reflections, and they seemed to be rather disappointed. So, if it was a totality in Brooklyn, I probably would find my glasses and go out and take a look. But 80%, 20% of the sun still gives you a lot of light. So I didn't remember at the time. So it just came and went. But I've been taking a look at the lovely pictures that people have been taking.
2ZV. I watched the NASA channel, and they had two feeds. One was a telescope only feed, and one was this, feed that was hosted by these very peppy younger people and switching around. And so I found the telescope feed to be much more peaceful.
Yeah, well, I think that they are more aesthetically pleasing because they're optimized to give you the best imagery of the eclipse, especially if you're in the totality and you can see the little ring around the outer side, and you can see the little corona, looking like little spikes coming out of that. So whereas if you just kind of point a filtered camera up into the sky, it's probably going to wobble and you're not going to have terribly good resolution.
There were a lot of those kind of photos, people taking pictures of themselves, selfies with the eclipse in the background and stuff like that. But I thought the interesting part about the whole exercise was that even the NASA channel didn't have very good control over the filters that are in the telescopes, or maybe the telescopes aren't built to have these kind of filters for eclipses. But, they had to switch filters at a certain point between no filter and then basically a sunglass level filter. And it didn't seem to be any in between. It didn't seem to be any way of getting a gradient between that. And so, as a result, it was difficult to see the Bailey's beads and the diamond ring. It either got blown out or was snuffed out, So they were sitting there going on and on about how wonderful it was, but we couldn't see it because the telescopes weren't actually as agile as people's eyeballs.
That's kind of true. Vision is logarithmic. It squeezes a lot of bandwidth and a lot of amplitude range, as a high dynamic range, as opposed to even the best modern electronic equipment. Also, you have to realize that there was no way for them to practice on an example sun eclipse. At best, they learned the proper neutral density filters back in, 2011, the last time there was an eclipse. And it's, you can't really simulate them well, so you can't really do any kind of test cases and get it right. So when you go live, it's the best image. You're kind of jumping around and adjusting things on the fly.
Yeah, and basically what's happening is you have all these different operators that are in that line up and down, and each one of the operators had their own different equipment that responded in different ways. And they also had their own technicians running that equipment who also had certain capabilities. And so there was a couple of feeds where they really did it pretty good. And it was easier to get the one afterwards than the one before. But there was one picture in particular which I was happy to get, which was a picture because they had some kind of lens problem and there was like some rainbows in it. It actually, I got that picture off the NASA feed, and I found out that that's the same picture that USA Today selected.
Yeah, I'm sure that there is a small number of very professional guys who do this as much as they can do this under the circumstances of the rarity. They know all the equipment, they know all the settings, and, they have good reflexes and kind of change on a dime if they need to. So there's going to be at least a few beautiful pictures, which everyone's going to see, and it's probably going to end up being a poster someplace. And so, I figured ahead of time that that's what I would settle for. I'll just wait until they print up a poster or something. I know it kind of sounds like I'm scientifically incurious, but, they're somewhat rare, but total eclipses have happened repeatedly. They're not a once-in-a-lifetime thing, although some political crazy people still kind of think that it's God telling them he's angry with them, which again, makes me kind of disappointed at humanity.
Well, actually, it's really not, because what's really happening out here with this particular eclipse is God is telling all the Muslims of the world that Ramadan is over. And then so Ramadan is over as soon as somebody sees the new moon, and that will be Eid al-Fitr. So I don't know if I can see it tonight. I've been planning on looking, but I haven't looked up yet. But that's the special thing about God and this particular solstice.
I thought the new moon was about a day or two ago.
It's the first new moon, so whoever sees it after the eclipse declares it. So you get people declaring 9, 10, and 11 at this point.
Okay. I will leave religious people to their own religious beliefs. It's interesting, you know. I mean, every so often, someone who doubts the whole idea of a round Earth will say that what kind of coincidence is it that the moon provides a shadow at the exact same diameter as the sun? You know, it can't be a coincidence. There's no such thing as coincidence, so there's got to be something behind it.
If you do the math, there's a range of calculations for moon sizes and sun sizes, and there's certain points where it's actually much longer because the Earth is different distance. I mean, the moon is different distances from the Earth. Depending how far away the moon is, the eclipse lasts different times. So, you know, like right now it's 4, like later it's going to be closer, it'll be 8, and then, you know, is it a perfect ring? It's not, because it's all like this big variable.
Well, I mean, in addition to that, the nature of the Earth and the moon, it's slowly getting farther away from us. So in a billion years, it's going to be significantly farther away that there won't be the same types of eclipses. So who knows? But I've heard people who don't facetiously question all of this, especially flat earthers.
I heard that the moon runs on basically an 18-year cycle in between the perigees and apogees and round and round, and when it light hooks up with where it first started, because it not only goes around the Earth, it actually goes up and down in front of the sun around the Earth. So it's like a very weird kind of harmonic oscillation.
Well, you're sort of talking about a three-body problem, which if you ever read the book or you watch the Netflix series, is a very real astronomical problem, calculating the interaction of three bodies interacting with each other. In only special cases can you predict what's going to happen, but in most cases, it's totally chaotic.
It gives all the astrologers their thing because, you know, all these minute shifts in gravity create all these minute nuances, and so that's what makes it all real.
Are you sure that you're not mixing astronomers with astrologers again?
No, I'm not really an astrologer club yet.
Yeah, you because you mentioned astrologers, it makes it complicated for astrologers. I don't think astrologers take into account almost anything. The constellations in the sky have shifted over the last 2,000-3,000 years. So the constellations that they work with have nothing to do with reality. So I don't think they care one way or the other about the perturbations of the moon's orbit around the Earth. They just go with what people did 2,000-3,000 years ago and try and make a buck out of it.
No, it's basically a very strange thing that they do track the planets very closely, who's rising, who's falling, where everybody is. But then again, all the mythology seems to have frozen in this chunk, which, as you say, is this delayed thing that's moving around. So, like, all of the Virgos or Scorpios or whatever it happens, I don't know how it's offset, but seems to work for them, so I don't usually subscribe to it, but I do know it's out there.
Well, it's definitely out there, but it's not really accurate. Every so often, a psychology professor will ask people what their birth date is, and then hand them specific analysis in a sealed envelope and ask them to open it up and silently read it. And then at the end of everyone reading it, the professor will ask, of all the people who've gotten envelopes and read them, do you feel that the entry that we've given you specifically related to your birthday correlates with your understanding of the way you are? And, you know, usually about 70% of the people will raise their hand, and then the professor says, well, actually, I gave all of you the exact same information. I just told you it was related to your birthday. So a good cold reader can scam almost anyone. And astrology books are full of easygoing type of descriptions that usually almost everyone will say, yeah, sure, I'm a very generous person and I'm very kind to my friends type of thing, even if they're miserable people who haven't given a dime to charity.
Well, I can hear you on that. And I think it's very interesting that it's progressed as far as it has. But the statements that they make aren't necessarily definitive. And it becomes then upon the person who reads the information to interpret the thing. And so then it becomes more of a matter of what we want something to say and how we interpret this information more than actually what the thing actually says. What do you think about that?
Well, again, they're designed to be vague and complimentary because most people will tend to agree with vague and complimentary. If it specifically says you have a brother named George and you don't have a brother named George, then it's really a bad prediction because most people don't have brothers named George. But if you go into a crowded room and you're talking to spirits and the spirits, there's an audience of, say, 200 people and there's a ghost called George and he says, my brother is here. Anyone have a brother who passed away named George? And surprisingly, two or three raised their hands. So it's a grift.
It's very a lot of fun for them and a lot of fun for the audience, right? That's why they pay their money.
Well, at the very best, it's fun. At the very worst, it's giving people false security about things, lying to them, and making them think things that don't exist exist, which can be problematic after a long enough time, again, where people start to interpret what their deity is trying to tell them by the fact that there's lunar eclipses and such. Anyway, enough of this. Let's go back on to technology. Let me throw out, for those people who don't tune into the Limark Technical Net, I did a puzzle that was very, very popular. I recently purchased a new wristwatch, which is a perpetual motion, solar-powered, and it synchronizes due to the atomic clock. So the problem is the atomic clock is located in Fort Collins, Colorado, which is a distance away. So even in the middle of the night, places like Brooklyn are the least likely to actually receive a decent sync signal. And I couldn't for the life of me get my watch to sync, so I had to do a little research. And I asked the people over at Limark what they thought would be a decent method of capturing the time standard for a clock that expects to receive it by WWVB, the time standard radio station. So any thoughts here?
My first question to you is what frequency are you trying to pick up, the 5 meg signal or which one?
Yeah. WWVB, which is the standard used by all the atomic clocks, is the low frequency one. It's 60 kilohertz.
Well, I guess you need a 60 kilohertz antenna, right?
Do you have any idea how big a full length 60 kilohertz antenna would be?
Colorado?
Well, it wouldn't be as far away, as long as from here to Colorado, but it's something like the wavelength is about 800 meters.
Put some magic in the watch to be able to make it pick up something. Maybe you should just go to the top of the Empire State Building and hold up your hand.
Well, I mean, that might work for one day, but I mean, they kind of expect you to synchronize it regularly. Matter of fact, the watch is set to receive the signal every night at around 2 a.m. That would kind of ruin your entire life. You couldn't do anything because you'd have to get to the Empire State Building by 2 a.m. every night.
That's, I was really joking around. There's got to be some clever way to handle this. Otherwise, you just buy a Timex and let it sit there. And then once a month, when you finally get the signal, you'll find out how much it was different from the Timex, because physically, you don't really care that much about what time it is, do you?
Anyway, like I was trying to say, I particularly like to have accurate time, and all the computers are synced and the cell phones are synced. They all kind of change time at the same exact time. So having one little clock off to the corner that's 10 or 15 seconds fast or slow can be mildly annoying. I'll give you a hint that there is a solution to this problem. Although the kind gentleman at Limark had all kinds of strange and yet interesting different descriptions. One was kind of just Googling it and reading instructions and telling me to open up the back of my watch and take a battery out and then put it back in, which he thought would have it start to receive the signal. And, you know, so he said, you know, go out to the middle of the street and disassemble your watch every night. And others would have me dangling it out the window. Others just kind of go and climb a hill every night. So there were a lot of interesting suggestions. That was not the one that I thankfully found.
Well, it seems to me the only way it's going to actually be able to do the updating is through some kind of local Bluetooth that updates your computers the same way, because you want everything synchronized, and your computers and everything else are already synchronized to a certain time standard. Whether it's stratum 2, 3, or 4 is an interesting question, but if you can get a stratum 1 time standard, you know, that's very, very important. But you then have to do something with it, like have a frequency counter that is basically at stratum 1 so that, you know, you can make sure your frequency counter is locked. So, you know, that's the importance of time, whereas, you know, I don't know. It seems like it would be an internet solution that the watch company would have figured out with the Bluetooth somehow.
Well, as far as the watch companies, no, they do not put Bluetooths in. It might be a power factor that, you know, it draws too much power for a tiny little watch, and so it would undermine the storage power capacity. But for whatever reason, they almost never, as far as I'm aware, Citizen has an endless series of watches that all use the atomic clock to synchronize it. None of them accept Bluetooth signals.
I think there must be a key in here somewhere, otherwise they would never be able to sell any watches.
Not necessarily. As I said, it's particularly the signal's particularly weak in Brooklyn. It's not like a Citizen's watch makes all their money from guys buying them in Brooklyn. You know, there's guys in Middle America. There are time standards in Japan, time standards in China, I think time standards in Europe. So, you know, it just so happens that for the United States, if you wanted to point to an area that's the worst reception for WWVB, it's basically the East Coast of the United States, like Brooklyn.
I think it's also Manhattan, too, because at one time I had a job where they were wanting to put this newsroom in, and so they had this bright idea of getting all these clocks, which would synchronize with the atomic clocks like yours, and they would just set them all an hour, you know, different, Tokyo, New York, Hong Kong, you know, stuff like that, and London. And so they had like 8 clocks along the room, and then it was supposed to be set it and forget it. And it was like set it and then drive yourself crazy resetting all the clocks, because their signal didn't get through to the building where it was in the center of Manhattan either.
Yes, it's not only good old Brooklyn. It's the East Coast and especially congested urban areas on the East Coast. Now, about, I think, 15, 20 years ago, some people involved in WWVB thought that what would be a good idea is to have a secondary station on the East Coast. And they were going to put it in Alabama. And they were going to, instead of using the 60 kilocycle frequency, because that would jam the WWVB, they were going to use an alternative at 40 kilohertz, because the Japanese time standard includes a reception at 40 kilohertz in addition to 60 kilohertz. But it got mucked down in bureaucracy and it never happened. So, you know, they they added, in addition to an amplitude modulated signal from Fort Collins, a phase shifted signal, thinking that the phase shifted signal might have a little bit more endurance. But it apparently didn't really have that much.
So then now we still have this question of how are they ever expecting to pick up a 60 kilohertz signal? They must have had an extremely well-tuned circuit, right, hiding inside the watch.
Well, you could, you know, I mean, if you have enough microvolts, you can build a receiver that can pick up the signal and boost it up and be heard. But for whatever reason, you know, not all atomic clock receiver front ends are as sensitive as others. I happen to have, you know, I've mentioned in the past that my house uses 1950 standard plaster technology. It used chicken wire, and then the plaster was applied on the chicken wire. So my house is kind of like a Faraday cage. So the best place to point any antenna is at a window, which I tried and it didn't work. But I do have a wall clock that's an atomic clock, but it has a much higher gain front end for the radio. So it'll sync without a problem in the middle of my house, whereas the new Citizen's Watch won't, and I have a small weather station device that's supposed to sync with the atomic clock that I keep in my bedroom that has never synced up. So of the my three atomic clocks, one of them could sync up, the other two couldn't.
I think that stuff in your house is different than chicken wire. I bet it's more like expanded metal lath, you know, which I've seen that type of construction. Chicken wire just seems too flimsy to me to hold plastic.
Well, I'm kind of using that as a shorthand description because most people don't know how anything is constructed. So if I describe it the way you just did, my guess would be about three quarters of the people I was talking to wouldn't know anything than what I was talking about.
But I'm too visual a person. When somebody says that, I immediately visualize whatever anybody's saying. And so I see chicken wire with plaster all over his head. That's not going to stick. I mean, I think some of the older construction was wood lath. You know, that had, that's what I've seen a lot of, wood lath. We have that down in the basement, plaster on top of that.
That's another big one, but they strung little bits of wire along with it to hold onto the plaster here. So, and I think that's not uncommon because there's a lot of people who have terrible radio reception inside their apartments, and I think it's primarily because of that, because that's really kind of the only thing that has a lot of metal in it. And it doesn't have to have a high percentage. It could be a kind of a network, a mesh, if you will, a very open mesh, and that's enough to block a lot of RF. Anyway, that's another distraction. Do you want to hazard any kind of a guess of how I was able to synchronize all my atomic clocks?
Well, I guess about two or three things were pretty poor guesses, and but I don't really know how you were able to do that. Maybe somebody else would like to guess.
Okay. Anyone else listening out there, hazard a guess, please do.
VB, I don't really have anything. I mean, I can say silly things. You just do it by hand by looking at the one that's synced, but I don't have any ideas.
Okay, I understand. It's a very absurd answer. And when I first found out about it, I thought someone was trying at a very bad joke, which is kind of what led me to make it a Limark TechNet puzzle of the week. Those are very few and far between. And this one was particularly successful. Anyone out there want to hazard a guess who didn't listen to last Sunday's Limark TechNet? Yes, William?
Is it something weird, like you stick a certain length of wire to the metal back of the watch and broadcast at another frequency right next to the thing, and it'll, like, bleed over enough to trigger the reception, but you have to, like, play back a recording at WWV? 82 to you.
Okay, Alex. Well, there's a couple of problems with that. You'd kind of need a transmitter. You'd need a modulator. You'd need some way of getting a time-synced signal into it. And, you know, someone kind of came up with the idea that they sort of remember reading that someone was going to build their own GPS, do-it-yourself WWVB. I haven't had a chance to look up whether anyone spent the time to do that. That's a kind of a real interesting high-tech thing that probably you'd have to dedicate a couple of years of your life to get it done quite right. But, I mean, theoretically, if you had a transmitter and you had the time codes at the right time, you could fake a WWVB transmission, which is getting precariously close to the actual solution.
I was going to tell you to tie a string to your watch and throw it on the roof overnight. Pull it back down in the morning. Over.
Yeah, that was one of the solutions. Paul WS2N, who does our SpaceNet report, suggested that I take my watch every night, put it in a non-conductive coffee can, and dangle it out my window every night.
Sounds like a smart guy. I'm glad we had a similar idea.
Okay. You know, I mean, he was much more confident that should it rain in the middle of the night, I wouldn't have a waterlogged watch, but the coffee can would have somehow kept it bone dry. The solution is that there is an app for that. Anyone with any thoughts about using a cell phone app to synchronize an atomic clock receiving watch?
I don't know how it works if the watch doesn't receive Bluetooth. You have to eventually get it into a radio signal, right? I mean, a quartz clock loses, what, 10 seconds a month or like a year? Realistically, your digital watch isn't going that far off, right?
Well, yeah, it's not going that far off, and you don't really need a Bluetooth on the cell phone to get a time standard because your cell phone is always connected to a cell tower that always has a time standard.
You have to modify the watch to receive a different frequency, and if so, why not just modify it to receive a frequency that you can broadcast locally?
Okay, so now you need someone who's a decent watchmaker and an electrical engineer. What's really going on here, and when I first heard it, it sounded like someone was making a joke, is there's an app for about $1.98. You open the app up, and it grabs the time code from some place, maybe the cell tower, I don't know. But it's a pretty good time standard. It then produces a sound signal, a 20 kilohertz sound signal with the time code embedded in the amplitude modulation of the 20 kilohertz sound cycle carrier using square waves. Square waves are rich in harmonics. So at the transitions, you don't only get 20 kilohertz, you get 30 kilohertz, you get 40 kilohertz. Well, you don't get 20 kilohertz. You get 20 kilohertz, you get 40 kilohertz, and you get 60 kilohertz. So what's happening is you're driving a loudspeaker electrically, and it's producing a little bit of harmonics because it's square waves. So the third harmonic is a 60 kilohertz electromagnetic pulse that's traveling a couple of inches away from your loudspeaker. If you put your watch really next to it, it believes that harmonic is WWVB, and it syncs with it.
Anything else you can break into if you can, like, essentially fake a radio signal on a certain frequency like that?
Well, I mean, it's not really practical because the amount of electromagnetic energy is very poor. That's why you really have to kind of put it right next to the other thing at the third harmonic. So, I mean, if you're talking standard radio waves, which are megahertz instead of kilohertz, the amount of energy in the harmonics that high up are practically zero. So although it's a great little trick for something that operates, and almost nothing we have operates at 60 kilohertz, but if you do have something that operates on the very, very low frequency band, it might be doable. If you want your cell phone's audio device harmonics to mimic a transmitter, you're not going to get very far.
I mean, the app is probably just going to time.gov. It's probably not even getting it off a cell tower. But maybe some sort of diagnostic on the phone displays this is the tower GPS.
Yeah, I haven't investigated where it grabs the time standard, but it's as close, you know, it's less than a second. You know, I don't have equipment to measure things in milliseconds. But I mean, once it syncs, I can put it right next to my computer and both of them go from, you know, 1 minute to the next minute at seemingly identical times. So for me, that's all I ask out of life. It doesn't have to be plus or minus 3 milliseconds. As long as I look at my my desktop and it says 9:55 and I look over to the side and my other atomic clock says 9:55, as opposed to previously, one would say 9:55, and very often the other one would say 9:54. Just annoy me a little bit.
On, I think it's cool on the solution on FT8 is the JT Sync app, which is it averages how far off all the other signals are, and then you sync your clock to that, or you can pick somebody whose clock is off and sync to them. But it makes it so you don't really have to have a GPS dongle. You can always, if you receive FT8 signals, you can average out what the real time is. Over.
Okay. Yeah, I guess so. I mean, every time I've ever used FT8, I've used it with my desktop computer that's hooked up to the internet, and I have an NTP that syncs it a regular period of times. And you know, thankfully, it doesn't need to be true to the millisecond, plus or minus probably 3 or 4 seconds, and still would kind of work, I would think. I'd have to look up the specs. I forget. But it's never really been a problem when I've done FT8 in my shack, and I've never done it mobile, so I haven't had to use those little tricks. But it sounds clever. You know, Joe's a clever guy.
Wait, you see the wallpaper I get when I figure out FT8 60 stories up.
Yeah, FT8 is very, very popular. Every so often, I go over to those frequencies, and they are always jammed. People are always looking for wallpaper. I never particularly caught that bug. So I remember when I was doing one of the Limar technical nets back when I wasn't running it, but I was just doing a segment so I could spend a little bit more time in the chat room. There was a nice guy who was just curious about FT8, and he set up FT8 at the same time that he was listening to the Limar technical net. And by the end of the technical net, he told me in the chat room that he found it a very unsatisfying thing. He said, it's not very challenging when you just set up a program and let it run pretty much by itself. So some people just like it because it gets the job done and you get the wallpaper. Others like to rag chew or don't like to be involved in modes that can be operated pretty much totally automatically.
I think it's wildly useful in figuring out how your signal's propagating and how your received signal, I don't know the word, how you're receiving that propagation. And because you can map it out. So it taught me a lot about what different bands do. Like, I wouldn't have realized 40 meters does, like, locally better, like, the closer states, without seeing the map.
Yeah, but you don't necessarily need FT8. There are a lot of other protocols that do either beacons or reverse beacons that will map your reception of your signal on a website, and you could see how far it's being picked up by different receiver sites. So it's not inherent in, say, FT8, but I mean, I think there's another Joe Taylor piece of software on that software application that bundles everything together that acts to do a better job of showing, you know, how far your signal is going.
Yeah, I open it up and eyeball it, and if I only see U.S. stations, then it tells me a lot about the band immediately without having to scroll through all of the sidebands. But I guess you could just listen to how noisy the band is too. But sometimes you know immediately if, with looking at the FT8 screen, if you're not going to hear anything outside of the U.S.
Yeah, there's that aspect of it. You know, I've occasionally I've actually cited almost next door neighbors who I think N2GOT at one point or another used to like to use it. I think I found him on the receiver a few times. But yeah, it's very useful. It's people love it, and it's very popular. A lot of times new technology comes out and a bunch of people jump on it, and then they get bored and then they leave. That hasn't been the case with FT8. I have not seen a diminution in what goes on there. I tend to, again, I'm more of a rag chewer. I'm more of a schmoozer. And even JS8 call is very, very limiting as far as conversation. You know, to have the conversation that we just had in the last 10 minutes would probably take about 3 hours because of the symbol rate of the transmissions that use that type of a mode.
I got to try out some of the digital modes. Sometimes I think it's tough to know what's an active digital mode and what is something that was popular 10 years ago, died off, and just lives in an option menu now that you can select. You know, like the Hell or whatever the other random digital modes say. They can't be a huge user base. AD2DU.
AC2GS. Yeah, you're quite right. I mean, there is software, and you go through the menu, and I would love to have a way of knowing what each mode actually sounds like. People have gone to the trouble of recording what the audio sounds like and posting it on websites. Ultimately, my findings are the 90% of people are using something Joe Taylor came up with, so that cuts it back. There are occasional RIDI contests, so RIDI is still alive, and especially during contest times, RIDI can be active. And there's occasionally PSK, but not a lot of it. And all the other ones, lots of luck. There's slow scan. I knew someone who wanted to go to Iceland and send slow scans of the land there, and she did it. I couldn't receive any of her signals, unfortunately, but she did it. But you know, hail and PSK, whatever. You know, there's about 30 different PSKs. I've never heard them actually on the air.
I figured out how to do slow scan TV, and it seems to be people posting very odd photos of cartoons.
Yes, they are very strange gentlemen who seem to have a large collection of circa Korean War postcards. And if you actually take a look at a lot of the images that are scanned and transmitted, they look a lot like what you would expect some Signal Corps guy to have a collection of from the Korean War.
Yeah, I don't know. I turn it on once in a while just to see what's going on, but it's some strange rangers.
Yeah, I agree with you. I kind of like to try every technology that's still active just to get a feel for what it's like. And so that's why I did the slow scan TV. And, you know, I must say, I found it sarcastically amusing, their aesthetic choices of pictures that they transmitted back and forth to each other. Yep. You can laugh or you can cry, so I choose to laugh. Anyway, once again, I'm AC2GS. This is the Kings County Radio Club Technical Net. Hope I haven't bent any ears out there. If there's anyone who has any question tonight for the Technical Net, please hit that push to talk and say hello. Okay, I will take that as a no thank you. Let's do the TechNet puzzle. Okay, so that's the TechNet puzzle for April 10th, 2024. It has an illustration of a schematic. It shows the waveform of the input and the waveform coming out of an amplifying bipolar transistor. And it gives you a choice of what kind of, it says the circuit shows an amplifier bias in what class. And it gives you the choice between Class A, Class B, Class AB, and Class C. So would anyone like to hazard a guess?
C2ZV.
AB2 to you.
Yes. William was first. Alex was second. So, William, what's your answer?
Class A.
Very good. What's your answer, Alex?
I was saying I forgot the public URL. I missed that. Over.
Okay. It's puzzle.kc2rc.com.
I'm not going to know this one. I memorized
Okay. Hopefully, you know, you'll learn them. I mean, basically, I just memorize the questions and the answers. But the rest comes if you give it an opportunity. William was quite correct. It's a Class A amplifier. The way you tell the difference between amplifiers is amplifiers will act on certain portions of the waveform. If it amplifies the entire waveform, that's the least efficient amplification circuit, but it has the highest fidelity, and it's called Class A. If you have an amplifier that is biased to only amplify half of the signal, it's considered a Class B. If it's less than half of the signal, it's Class C. If it's someplace between 100% and 50%, it's Class AB. The illustration shows identical waveforms as the input and output, so it amplifies the entire waveform, which is Class A. So that's why William is correct. It is a Class A amplifier. The amplifier is biased to operate in Class A. Again, Class A gives you the best fidelity, but at the lowest efficiencies. Class C gives you the lowest fidelity at the highest efficiencies.
QZV?
Yes, William? Yes, William?
QZV comment?
Yes, William. I hope you hear me.
Oh, Roy, I was trying to talk to you, and then you said, hope you hear me, and there was a lot of clicking, so I wasn't hearing anything there for a few seconds.
Okay, but whatever it is, it seems to have settled down, so what do you want to say?
I was saying that you could probably have taken that same picture and then showed like a chopped wave on the output, and then it would have been Class C, because pretty much there's still values in there, and you could have just driven that transistor into the Class C operation, right?
Yes, it could have been Class B, A, B, or C. It could have been any of those just by whiting out a portion of the output waveform. It just is a question that kind of you need to understand what a Class A amplifier is to answer this particular version of the question.
Same circuit would work for pretty much all those classes of amplifier, right? Just the picture is what we're really talking about.
Yes, it's the picture that's theoretically based upon the bias resistor. Depending upon, you know, there's a voltage divider network before it gets to the transistor, and it feeds the gate. So that kind of the two resistances that divide the voltage determine the bias and determine the cutoff point for the amplification.
The point is, since we don't know those resistors, all we have to depend on is actually the two waveforms is a part of the problem. So anyway, thought there was a fun one, Roy.
Yeah, I mean, we know it not based on the values of, because if you had the values of the resistors, you'd also need to have the characteristics of the transistor too. But if you're seeing what the waveform input and the waveform output is, by definition, you're showing a Class A bias amplification circuit. So it works out. You know, I don't think this is one of my trickier questions. We've gone over classes of amplifiers at least three or four times in the past. We'll probably mention them again as time goes on.
ZV.
Yes, Bob?
ZV Roy.
What was that, William?
On the radio.
ZV, I don't
know.
What
about the radio? I don't know. Things are acting a little quirky right now. You know, I hear people start conversations and then they don't reply. Maybe I'm just not picking it up on my antenna. I don't know.
ZV, I just heard you that time, Roy.
Okay. I mean, you pretty much should be hearing me. I mean, the radio is transmitting, so I assume it's transmitting the audio.
It is now, and it was almost all the time, but just for that, I don't know, a minute or so. I don't know if you heard me and were telling me to go ahead, or I don't. At that point, we just didn't hear you for maybe a minute or something, and now we're hearing you again.
Okay, don't have the faintest idea, because I pretty much always these days hopefully look down at the waveform, I look down at the transmitter, and I see it's red. So, you know, occasionally, unfortunately, if the cursor's in the wrong place and I push down, or sometimes even if the cursor's in the right place, and if I don't kind of double-check Echolink, sometimes it's, it doesn't quite catch. Nevertheless, Bob, I thought that you had thrown your call sign out that you wanted to say something.
Yes. Yeah, I was just going to comment that the thing I learned, well, I'm still not good with schematics, but turns out all I needed to know is what those squiggles were. I didn't know what those squiggles were. and I kind of generally know what a Class A, B, and C amp is. Says, oh, of course, that's just the waveform, which you started saying, but it didn't occur to me before. So the new thing I learned was, oh, those squiggle things are part of schematics that tell you what the waveform is. So back to you, Roy.
Okay, yeah, I mean, you kind of see from the schematic that that's the first squiggle is at the input, and the last squiggle is at the output, and it's a very simplified, bipolar transistor amplifier with some coupling capacitors to kind of get rid of the DC offset from the signal, and a voltage divider to bias the transistor. So, I guess I could have made it more obvious. I don't know, but okay.
Nothing wrong you did. I've just never, what little I learned about schematics, I've forgotten half of that. I need to learn schematics, but I just didn't even know that squiggle symbol. Maybe it should have occurred to me. Of course, that's a sine wave, one period, or whatever, I guess you'd call it a period. And, it's obvious now, but it just didn't occur to me. My bad, or nobody's bad, maybe I just have to learn that. Now I've learned that.
Okay, it's something you pick up. It's not really part of a schematic. It's just part of the illustration to kind of denote what was going in as input and what was coming out as output. So don't worry about it. Anyway, this continues to be AC2GS. This continues to be the Kings County Radio Club Technical Net. We've done our little TechNet puzzle for the week. Anyone with any questions or comments or topics for discussion before we kind of put this to sleep for this week?
Good evening, Roy. This is KD2VA with a question.
I'll just do it.
Sure, Maxim.
I get all those things we've talked about before from the repeater. When people finish their transmission, like, oh, you get this, this thing coming over. I notice the only difference is when I have my mic plugged in, sometimes, though not always, I'll hear an additional click coming from my power supply. When I pull out the mic, I never hear that. Sometimes even when I put it in, it just doesn't do it for a long time. So it seems to be something my mic's doing that makes that happen. And what is that? When you hear a click coming from the power supply. Back to you, Roy.
Okay, unfortunately, you doubled with Maxim. We'll get to you in a couple of minutes, Maxim. That's called the squelch crash, and the repeater has been showing it a lot lately. When you release your push-to-talk, I've heard at least four squelch crashes. I tried to kind of tweak and adjust the timer settings. It's not really a problem with EchoLink, but it can sometimes feed back on itself, and that could be a problem with EchoLink. But for some odd reason, your transmission is giving the repeater, is confusing the repeater. It thinks that you're quitting multiple transmissions, one after the other, instead of just one clean on, then off. And I don't exactly know what thing is doing it, but there's something in your transmission that the amplitude is probably not just going full quiet. It's probably bouncing a little bit, I guess, on the transmitter stage of the radio.
So you think it's just from just my transmission? So maybe there's some little thing wrong with my radio, or it's the thing with the mic, somehow the plug-in with the mic. Because on my end, whether it's me I'm listening to you and other people talk, occasionally I hear this extra click. It comes from the direction of my power supply, which is off back a little ways from where not the power supply, it's probably the radio body. Silly me, they're right next to each other. But even most of the time not. But I think it's still like a dodgy connection with my mic, even though I bought a new microphone. I think the female plug in the radio where the mic goes in is probably a little wonky, but just a little. Anyway, back to you.
Yeah, for the most part, I haven't heard it in a long time. But when you unkeyed after saying hello, I think it chunked four times. If you have nothing better to do someday, just pull one of these archived recordings and take a little listen. You'll get a feel for what's going on.
So you're saying it's not all the time. It's just once in a while, or is that what you're saying? Back to you.
Yes, it's once in a while. It kind of is more pronounced early on. You know, maybe as your radio warms up, whatever is kind of doing it stops doing it.
Okay. Yeah, my radio. You know, it's obviously like all radios, almost except for the old ones. It's transition stuff. I guess they still warm up. But does it matter that even it's often kind of warmed up? Even because when I don't use it as a radio, I often use it as an FM receiver. I use it all the time for that, too. Anyway, back to you.
You have to function in the fact that it uses a significant greater amount of energy and dissipates a lot more heat when it transmits than it receives. So there's a difference between a radio that's just kind of on. And we're not really talking about frequency shifting because of the crystal temperatures and such. I'm just talking about the general temperature in the chassis and the component values that tend to get affected when the temperature shifts 10, 15 degrees, you know. And you're not going to really see that much of a temperature rise just using your radio as a receiver as opposed to pumping out whatever 30 watts of power out the antenna.
Got it. Yeah. I think, in fact, as soon as I asked that question, I go, of course, transmission's a lot more than energy than receiving. Back to you.
Yeah, yeah. Well, I mean, whatever is causing it, fortunately, you know, I haven't heard it once in our conversation right now. So it might have just been something that happened either positionally or temperature, whatever changed in the last hour or so.
I wonder if the thing I was talking about, the extra thing that only occurs occasionally with the mic plugged in and never when it's not plugged in, when I hear a click, it's obviously coming from the radio proper, not, you know, I have the same radio, the 7100 you have with the head floating here. I wonder if it's the same time. But of course, I also hear it a lot when other people are conversing and I'm just sitting here listening to you guys. Anyway, mysteries. We still have mysteries to solve in the future.
Yep. Well, maybe we'll solve them at some point. Yeah, I mean, the IC7100 does make some clicking when it shifts antenna settings and power settings and such. So maybe we'll figure it out one day. Anyway, this is AC2GS with the Kings County Radio Club Technical Net. Maxim, KD2VEA, you said you had a question?
Yeah, hey, Roy, this is KD2VEA. Just curious, short question. During the eclipse, I was thinking that, hey, there's a lot of solar activity. Maybe, you know, the bands will be really open. But then Alex, was it like, who got the call sign, but they're saying that the bands were actually quite noisy. So I was wondering, if it was a solar event, is it good for the bands or bad for the bands?
Well, it sort of depends on the event and the band. The eclipse, there's a lot of guys who have done a lot of measurements and we'll hear about it in the following weeks, if not months. My guess is that totality just affected very few people, relatively speaking, for only about 4 or 5 minutes. That's really not enough time to kind of relax the ionosphere. It's not like it's a light switch where, you know, it goes out, you know, the instant you flick the switch. So my guess is unless you're using JPL high sensitive equipment, there will be no discernible change in the propagation during the eclipse and before it and after. As far as it depends on the solar event. An eclipse is just kind of blocking the solar energy that energizes the ionosphere. So theoretically, if you blocked it for a more significant time than 4 minutes, you would de-energize things like the F1 and F2 ionospheric layer, which would decrease the propagation on something like 10 meters. Also, if you block the sun for a significant amount of time, like is often seen during the middle of the night, you would de-energize the D layer, which introduces a lot of noise to 80 meters and 160 meters. So that's why the lower bands of 160 and 80 work at night and not during the day, because the D layer is energized and rather than really produce a lot of useful propagation, injects a lot of random noise to obscure the underlying signals.
Interesting. Okay, so maybe that wasn't... You did mention that it might have been something else in the setup. I didn't really know you in the band. But so interesting to know. I was kind of like hoping it would be a huge event for radio, but I guess people were just looking on the eclipse. Although, from pictures, Alex was mostly working on the radio, which is impressive.
Yeah, it's very physically impressive, especially if you're at the totality. I don't know if you made any observations here. I know a guy in Queens who kind of looked off reflections, and he was sort of disappointed. He was kind of expecting something vaguely similar to the areas of totality, where it gets very dark. But, you know, 20% of visible sunlight is enough to keep everything bright and shiny.
I wasn't disappointed. First of all, I took my kid out to go see it. We had the special glasses. It was still very cool to see it be like 85% covered when the moon was passing by. It was a sliver of the sun left. So it was really cool to see it. The colors turned all gray and, you know, kind of like washed out a little bit. So still, it was a really cool event. Even if it wasn't total, you know, total coverage, I thought it was really fun to see. Whether I didn't really need it to be a full to truly enjoy it. And my daughter was kind of excited about it about like 5 minutes and then she got bored.
Okay, that's at least 5 minutes of excitement. A lot of people would pay a lot of money for 5 minutes of excitement. Yeah, I mean, as long as you had the proper eyesight protection, because a lot of people wreck their eyeballs for these things. No matter how many times people tell other people not to stare at the sun, there's always people who think that that rule doesn't apply to them. I had a gentleman on the Limar TechNet who wanted to use the glasses they give you after cataract surgery because they're basically optical density lenses, but they're not high enough to block all the light coming out of the sun. So I'm glad you took the proper protection for you and your daughter.
Yeah, we took it seriously, and yeah, ND filters, depending on their density, would probably not be enough. We tested them. The rule was, if you can put them on and look at like regular light, and if you can see anything, they're not good enough. NDs were pretty much opaque until we started looking at big light. And the only thing you could see was LSD. That was pretty cool, I gotta say. I did enjoy the event. Did you get to take a look as well, or not really?
No, I figured that, you know, there are photographers making a nice living by taking pictures of it. I would wait for theirs. We had a couple of people at the other TechNet who were steam fitters and such, so they had welding helmets, and they were going to use the ultraviolet and general light protection. Because if you wear those helmets, you can't see anything. If you start up their equipment, then you first see a light, but it's much dimmer. So and there were pictures I saw in the newspapers with similar helmets on. So that was not just something that steam fitters thought of.
Oh, interesting. Do you think that the arc welding goggles or mask, are those efficient?
Well, I think so. I don't know if anyone's done any real research, but apparently, also there are different types of welders' glasses. So the guy on the other net mentioned that, you know, he would look for a higher number, 10 or 11 or such. So I guess you can do it wrong by getting the lowest opacity glasses. But I would assume that, you know, if that solution didn't work, since so many people tend to be using it, we would hear alerts out there. For God's sakes, don't borrow your uncle's welding helmet.
Yeah, that's a good point. I didn't hear anything like that. All right, cool. That's all I wanted to know.
Yeah. Welders have particular problems every so often. Usually it's not a welder himself, but if the welder is doing something and one of the other guys is nearby and he's not wearing a helmet because he's not welding, you can sunburn your eyeballs, which is a very annoying thing. It's not immediate, so you walk away and you don't think anything of it, but a few hours later, it's like a bad sunburn. You know, when you leave the beach, you're feeling pretty much okay. It's as the night progresses that all of a sudden it starts to burn and itch and hurts and all kinds of things.
Okay, well, that doesn't sound like fun. I've done burns on my eyeballs.
Yeah, the way people tend to describe it is it feels like you have sand in your eyes, and you can't get it out of your eyes. And usually, you know, it hits them a couple hours after they leave their job. So, I mean, it's a bitch trying to sleep under those circumstances. It goes away after a few days for the most part, you know, as long as the exposure isn't severe.
Got it. All right, well, that's pretty much it. I think it ends up wrapping up and to bed.
Okay, very good. Sounds like a plan. Once again, I am AC2GS. This is the Kings County Radio Club Technical Net. If anyone has any further questions or comments to make before we close this episode of it, please hit the push to talk. Okay, that was 100% noise. So you got into the repeater, but you wasn't able to get any audio out. So if you can raise your power, adjust the orientation of your antenna, or go out to a hill above your house to get a better reception of the repeater site, give it another try. Oh, well, nothing heard. Better luck next time. This net has been brought to you by the Kings County Radio Club. Our club is an ARRL-affiliated club based in Brooklyn, New York, and we meet on the first Wednesday of each and every month. Our next meeting will be May 1st, which will be held by teleconference. Club members will be emailed with the details of logging into the meeting. Non-members wishing to join a general meeting can email me, AC2GS, with some form of identification for the required link. Although our meetings informally begin after 7 p.m., our formal regular general meeting starts at 8 p.m. and continues anywhere from about 9 to 10 o'clock, depending upon the number of points that are covered. We have a weekly 2-meter club net on every Tuesday night at 9 p.m. on this repeater, and this technical net meets on the second and fourth Wednesday of each and every month at 9 p.m. We also sponsor a 10-meter net every Sunday morning at 11 a.m. on 28.380 or nearby, our sideband. We offer an audio stream of our KC2RC repeater on the internet, as well as our 10-meter net. Just point your browser to stream.kc2rc.com. Members as well as non-members are welcome to participate, although we do appreciate it when our fellow hams join our club, and as always, an application is readily available on our club's website. If you would like to contact the host of this technical net, simply address your email to tech@kc2rc.com. We maintain an active website at www.kingscountyradioclub.com or www.kc2rc.com, which offers archives of this technical net, amateur radio news, original articles, and technical forums. Please visit our website and participate. Our website hosting services were generously donated by the local Brooklyn-based web hosting company, Three Aliens Web Hosting, who we would like to thank. As the great philosopher Jimi Hendrix once said, knowledge speaks, but wisdom listens. So try to listen more and talk less. Well, it's time to roll it all up and shut it all down, but we'll be back again April 24th, and you're all welcome to join us. Thanks to everyone that participated tonight, especially my co-host, Bob KD2NVB. Without you guys, I would just be talking to myself. So, this is Roy, AC2GS. I'll be going clear and getting the heck out of here. Have a great week. Stay safe, be well, and we'll talk to you down the line. This is AC2GS clear.